Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Platypuses, the extraordinary story of how a curious creature baffled the world. A beautiful book by Anne Morrell, and I'm really pushing myself and hopefully really improving in cardiac rehab, or sort of the cognitive rehab, being able to read better and read with expression. Easily get there. So we've just gone through this rather almost creepy thing where they've discovered that the mammals platypuses are mammals. But this one is chapter 5 in our fifth episode. It's called, entitled, The Land of Contraries. Contrarities. I love that word. It's sort of like, it's almost unreadable. And there's a quote at the start. In this remote part of the earth, nature, having made horses, oxen, ducks, geese, oaks, elms, and all regular productions of all the rest of the world, seems determined to have a bit of play and to amuse herself as she pleases. By Reverend Sydney Smith in Sydney, 1819, in the European Vision of the South Pacific. The problem of locating specimens to settle the rising debate of the platypus caused maddening delays for the British and European men of science. Yet, since the animal's first disconcerting experience in England in 1799, materials and information from New South Wales itself was fragmentary and contradictory. Joseph Banks' overtures to its colonial botanical contacts during the new century's first decade had managed to extract remarkably little new information for naturalists at home about either the platypus or the echidna. In late 18... So there's a couple of echidnas up around here in the bush, but it's generally a bit wetter, and I don't think they like hills and cliffs. They tend to fall off them. Generally, as late as 1818, 2 years before his death, the Royal Society's aging but indefatigable president was still applying gentle pressure to the colonial governors and the viceregal mind with the mysteries of the duckbill reproductions. That's a quote. The study of zoologically took root very slowly in Australia. For the first decade or so after the establishment of the small penal settlement at Port Jackson, on Sydney Cove in 1788, there was a burst of interest in natural science. Governors, ship surgeons, and officers of the First Fleet, educated men, often with artistic leanings, recorded impressions of the extraordinary animals in a state of enlivened wonderment at what they saw. With facile brush and pen, they captured the small jewel-like birds and laughing kookaburras and rainbow-hued parakeets and aberrant black and white cockatoos. Can I say, the parrots here are absolutely mad. Okay. Well, the blue frogs, the dozy koala. Oh, the koala didn't come for a long time. The quick slink skinks and lizards were seen on their manuscripts and drawings for publication in England. Convicts with artistic skills sharpened by acts of forgery, which is bloody hell as always, had sent them to New South Wales, were also put to work in the natural history illustrators for governors and high-ranking officers, provide the vivid and original wildlife illustrations that resonate with their sense of strangeness of today. But the actual collection and preparation of natural history materials, especially faunal specimens, required the mastery of techniques to which few residents of the infant colony could aspire. Botanical collections of unique flora began to brilliantly by the youthful Banks, and encouraged throughout his life, had little counterparts in zoology. Even so, the challenge for botanists was profound. The renowned British botanist Sir James Smith summed it up. When an observer entered a remote country like Australia, he wrote, he could scarcely meet with any fixed point from which to draw his analogues. Quote, whose tribes of plants first seem familiar prove, on near examination, total strangers. And not only the species that present themselves are new, but most of the genera and even the natural orders. Robert Brown in Motion. The investigator's talented botanist, destined to become a preeminent figure of the 19th century science, found it all too true that he collected at many points around Australia's coast. you still brown-faced the problems for which the Lyanian system classification proved no answers. Collecting wildly, he gathered a vast diversity of plants through their various stages of maturation and devised his own system of classifying them into families and genera. In doing so, he moved away from the wild accepted Lyanian system, which was based on the reproductive organs, the stamens and pistils, and as a criteria for basic divisions into classes or family, gender, and species, adopted his own system, founded on the anatomy and physiology of the plant's parts. Well, that's going to be very interesting. I didn't know that aspect. I wonder if that's all this put down. When the Baron's famous Prodromus Flora Nova Hollander, with 464 genera and 2,000 species of Australian plants, all new to science, were published in 1811, it transformed the study of botany. It offered reference guide for local residents to provide a point that classical system fixed with such confidence in Europe were unable to sustain the weight of the large new edition from another hemisphere. The challenge was similar but more demanding in zoology. Early colonists possessed scientific training. Their library's resources were small. A few, if any, were acquainted with the theoretical concepts about Australia form was circulating in the scientific circles of Britain and Europe. Hence, for a good two decades, the 19th century, autonomous and theorists overseas had to rely on rough descriptions and very occasional specimens sent by British travellers and agents visiting New South Wales. God, you Aussies. No way, mate. But my bloody platypus up there. I just mind its own business. One colonist, however, whose information could be relied upon was the high-flying authority of the influential Pastorius, Sir John Jamieson. Well, bloody hell. I think there's my kids were born at the Jamieson Hospital, and there is a Jamieson. I wonder if it's him. A trained medical man, Jamieson had served in the Royal Navy and won a knighthood when he, as the physician serving in a hospital ship, the Baltic Fleet in the Napoleonic War in 1809, he succeeded in curbing a serious outbreak of scurvy. In 1816, his own observations were communicated to the Society in London, offering specific information about the platypus. Quote, "The female," he conveyed succinctly, "is oviparous and lives and burrows in the ground so that it is seldom seen either on the shore or in the water." That is true. The platypus warrens are just mind-boggling. They are absolutely mind-boggling. So it's interesting. I wonder where lived in here. I'll have to search him up. Jamieson. I wonder if he's the Jamieson that we've got everything named after. Sometime later in January 21, Patrick Hill, a naval surgeon on active service responding to the Admiralty's directive to naval officers to send back useful observations on natural science, also wrote to the Lyanes Society from Sydney reporting on his discussions of the female Ornithohobrigensis, in which he found, quote, "In the left ovum, a round yellow ovum about the size of a small pea, with two similar size and immense number of minute vesicles. He'd sent an Oxford University for examination. Although the eggs had not been laid, Hill reported from talk with Aborigine elder that, quote, that it is a fact well known to them that the animal lays two eggs about the size and shape and colour of those of a hen. A female sits a considerable time on the eggs, in which it is always found amongst the reed on the surface of the water. The early fragments of information prove remarkably close to the truth. Yet a barrier existed between the theorists and the Briton and the raw information plucked from the Australian field. British nationalists were inclined to indulge in the lofty view of the colonies, of monitorings, marsupials and men. They perceived Australians as a formal backwater, a kind of zoological penal colony. And while they strove to carry off the laurels of scientific classification and build a personal reputations on their interpretation of specimens that reached them, they viewed Antipodean apparitions and an aversion as taunt and hard-won truths of European science. To Englishmen especially, Australia was a land of deviations and contrarieties. It departed from their norm. The convicts, the very outcasts of their own society, grew rich and emancipated and became influential on the land. That really pissed them off. Their signs of real prosperity and local mobility marked a country where the refuse and dregs of civilized society were consigned. It was not just the plants and animals that veered so sharply from their European kind. The visiting French zoologist, François Perrin, writing of his experience, had added his measure of doubt and incredulity for the place he felt impelled to call the unparalleled continent. For Perrin, too, the sense of reversal from physical and social norms went hand in hand. I love the fact that this has got so many layers. It's got, like, the author herself is rejected, she's an independent scholar, and the scientists are rejecting the Australian society and they're rejecting the animals. It's so good. Restarting this paragraph. To the Englishman especially, Australia was a land of deviations and contraries. It departed from the norm. Their convicts, the very outcasts of their own society, grew rich as emancipists and became influential in the land. There, signs of real prosperity and social mobility marked a country where the refuse and dregs of a civilized society were consigned. It was not just the plants and the animals that veered so sharply from the European kind. The visiting French zoologist, François Pion, writing of his experience, added his measure of doubt and credulity for the place he felt impelled to call the unparalleled continent. For Perrin, too, the sense of reversal on physical and social norms went hand in hand. The surprising effects of transportation, even in 1802, struck him with awe. While the natural phenomena of singular company were equally strange and incomprehensible, he compared the unpredictability of the natural world and noted, amongst the vegetable and animals, nature has multiplied her singularities. When visiting Irishman Jack O'Hara came to dash off his impressions of New South Wales in 1817, it seemed to him also nature had surely, quote, indulged in a whim in Australia. Quote, she sometimes mimics herself, he writes, in giving to smaller animals, such as the native rat, the general form and characteristics of a kangaroo. She gives a number of specialities, the false belly of the animal, the numerous instances animals were discovered, which might at first sight be considered monstrous productions, such as the aquatic quadruped about the size of a rabbit, with the eyes and colour and skin of a mole, and the bill and web feet of a duck, a parrot with slender legs of a seagull, a skate with a broad head of a shark. The whole animal creation, he included, appeared to be different from that of any other region. Even sophisticated long-term English settlers responded sharply to the country's contrariness. When a small elect coterie of scientifically minded men met in Sydney in 1821 under the patronage of their astronomer governor, Sir Thomas Brisbane. Oh, there you go. So Brisbane was the governor. To form the embryonic Philosophical Society of New South Wales, they deplored the lack of local attention given to research while they fretted at the precarious and singular conundrums of the country. Quote, upwards of 30 years have now elapsed since the colony of New South Wales was established in one of the most interesting parts of the world. Oh well, yeah. Interesting as well as from the novel and endless variety of its animals, visual productions, as from its wide and extending range for observation and experiment. Yet, little has been done to awaken the spirit of research, to excite the thirst for information amongst the colonists. When we consider that we are speaking in the 19th century and reflect upon the progression of science for nearly 3,000 years, the rejection and the adoption of various systems in every branch of natural history, and the security which it was fancied that scientific arrangements had had at least attained. We are most inclined to believe that nature has been leading us through a mazy dance of intellectual circulation, only to laugh at us in this fifth continent. I love that. This is only Aussies like this type of stuff. The society's moving spirit, Baron Field, an active and cultured lawyer who had been in the colony several years, plunged into poetry to sum up his thought on a country that defined even superbly cheated nature's normal laws. Kangaroo, kangaroo, thou spirit of Australia, that redeems from utter failure, from perfect desolation, and warrants the creation of this fifth part of the earth, which would seem a afterbirth, not conceived at the beginning. For God blessed his work at first, and saw that it was good, but emerged at the first thing, when the ground was therefore cursed, and hence his barren wood. Kangaroo, kangaroo, this is really bad poetry. Thou first sight, we should say, in thy nature there may, oh God, it goes on, contradictions be involved, yet like discord was resolved, it's quickly harmonized, sphinx and mermaid realized, or center in fabulous. Would scarce be more prodigious, but that nature would compile, nature knows to reconcile. Bounding o'er forest place, joyed by some divine mistake, none but nature's hand can make, nature in her wisdom play on creation's holiday. For howsoe'er anomalous thou art, thou yet art not incongruous, repugnant, and preposterous. When sooty swans are once more rare, and duck moles in the museum's care, be still the glory of this land, happiest work of finest hand. Well, I think this still gives you a flavour of these people who think they can pen poem, and everyone used to write poetry. Oh, gosh. And there's some works, there's appalling works of poetry that I can read in the Historical for Society. Over and above, versifying Field was a serious contributor to colony science. Australia might be a land of contraries, where the laws of nature seem reversed, but zoology was no longer a study of dried birds. Australia's zoology, he contended crisply in the writing of 1825, can only be studied and unravelled on the spot, that to only by a profound philosopher. Such a message found scant resonance in the professional circles at the metropolis. Ships carrying assortments of Australian animals dead and alive plied their way to England for distribution to zoological gardens and museums. James Hardy Vaux, transported as a convict to New South Wales and recording his impressions in 1819, wrote that his ship was crowded with kangaroos, emus, black swans that resembles Noah's Ark. Given their problematic place in the systematic scheme of things, museums often seize had difficulty in arranging some of Australian items on display. As a result, a stuffed platypus appeared in one provincial museum's display of cosily naturalised amongst the creatures of the British woods and fields. By the 1820s, most major museums in Europe supported a stuffed Australian animal or two procured for them by British agents. And it's interesting that this is, museums agents used to be a big thing overseas. They make a lot of money out of selling to private collections and stuff like that. Baron Field, in Sydney, frustrated by the lack of zoological expertise or instruction available in New South Wales, decried the way that many primitive private specimens were allowed to be purchased by foreign museums. He fed the patriotic zeal, quote, "It is surely a national disgrace," he disclaimed, "that we should conquer and acquire colonies, and that the other nations should reap the honour of their zoological history." Yet the problem remained. Information of all sources from the Fricus colony was treated in Britain with prejudice and caution. During 1828, as a debate on the question of the platypus's mammary simmered in Europe, Peter Cunningham of the Royal Naval Surgeon Superintendent of Convicts in New South Wales, writing popular travel books of his 2 years in the colony, added further evidence to the local view that the platypus laid eggs. It was, he recorded, a, quote, remarkable animal, which forms a link between bird and beast, having bill like a duck, paws webbed similar to that of a bird, but legs and a body of those of a quadruped, discovered with coarse hair and a broad tail, deceived by the hair of platypus is so fine and soft. Quote, it was believed to lay eggs, and nest eggs in a peculiar appearance was some time ago found. Cunningham, who had lived in the colony intermittently over several years, observed the platypus in its natural habitat as well as dissecting a specimen, was first from the field since Governor Hunter to report that, quote, the male bears a claw on the underside of the foot, having a tube therein through which it emits poison fluid into the wounds which its claws inflicts. As, when assailed, it strikes its paws together and fastens upon the enemy like a crab. Well, these platypuses have a poison claw. Other visitors crowded to give testimony. Sir John Henderson, a surgeon of the Indian Army, visiting the colonies from Bengal in 1829, added his opinion, accompanied by his colourfully clad Hindustani servant. He sighted a platypus in the rivers of New South Wales and Tasmania on frequent occasions, observing that the little creature swam low in the water, dived rapidly, but it was tiresomely difficult to shoot. Henderson's shoot, bloody hell, it's just so tiresomely difficult to shoot. Henderson was au fait with the debate about the animal's reproductive processes, whether viparous or oviparous, but which was right. All was second hand. A gentleman residing in the River of the Hunter, New South Wales, he offered, has assured me that one dissected female with which had several eggs was discovered of different degrees of maturity. Invigorated by Tasmania's cool air and its effects on his delicate constitution, Henderson flushed out a group of scientifically minded residents of Hobart and launched the Van Diemen Land Scientific Society for the purpose of fixing their attention on the puzzles of natural science. Launched under vice-regal patronage, the society attracted visiting British national scientists, fellow of the Royal Academy, Matthew Friend, who, moving between Sydney and Tasmania, carried a fistful of introductions from the Royal Zoological and Geological Societies of London, with requests to establish scientific correspondence in the colonies. Their land of mystery, with its anomalies, he reminded his new members, would, if verified and described, quote, tend much to illustrate many of the most abstruse and important questions in the history of organic life. Yet few, if any, of the scattered company of amateur naturalists, the resident clergymen, doctors, surveyors and administrators from their respective locations in New South Wales, Tasmania and Victoria were in a position to investigate the remarkable new species and offer an informed perspective on known forms. Cut off by distance, they avoided speculative hypothesis and left sorties into categorisation and theory to scientists abroad. Even verification and specific descriptions were, in the case of zoology, apt to meet difficulties. Tasmanians admitted the challenge when, shortly after the demise of Van Diemen's Land's Scientific Society, a more enduring Tasmanian Society of Natural History was formed in Hobart in 1839. They took Bulbinch Ornithorhynchus Paradoxus to as an element and added to the title page of this society's journal. The Latin motto is, from whatever you look at it, this will be a paradox. On the cover of their first minute book, the anonymous scribe jotted pithily, all things are queer and possible. So that's the end of chapter 5. We're going into chapter 6. Let's see how many pages that is. I don't want to leave you halfway through.
24 minutes. Just read into this and see how long it takes. It may take an hour. That's it, because we've got to crash through this.
The first hard look. Okay, the quote at the start. The title is Chapter 6, The First Hard Look. Those who are accustomed to the view and investigate the varying productions of nature can appreciate the true feeling of enjoyment experienced on seeing their native haunts, creatures which before were known only in vague descriptions. George Bennett, a water mole of Australia. There, the water mole. And from 1835, merchant and naval vessels that plied their way from the United Kingdom to far corners of the Indian and Pacific Oceans in the 19th century carried on their ranks doctors and naturalists, a breed of enterprising men whose minds and eyes were astir with the wonders of the New World. George Bennett, born in 1804 amid ship's masts of Plymouth, was a young man whose sort of adventure, love that, beautiful English, educated at the local grammar school. His inquisitive mind flew out beyond the musty scent of the classrooms, and in 1819, at the age of 15, he sailed before the mast of Ceylon and the island of Mauritius. Isn't that beautifully put there? You know, it's such a beautifully themed. His mind flew beyond the musty scent of classrooms. Back in London in 1820s, he studied anatomy and medicine at Middlesex Hospital and the Hunterian School of Medicine, and gained a diploma in the Royal College of Surgeons, where he forged friendship with the young contemporary Richard Owen, which was profoundly to influence his career. In 1829, his medical degree behind him, Bennett's was back at sea again. This time he travelled as a ship's surgeon on the vessel, trading vessel, Sophia, which carried him in charge of 92 male convicts to Sydney and on to New Zealand and the Pacific Islands of Asia. From his days at the Royal College of Surgeons, Bennett was aware of the platypus interest. Owen was dissecting his first quote, old specimen at that time, and in his short stay in Sydney, he heard from local sources that the platypus laid eggs, but he wrote later, the majority preferred forming theories of their own, arguing their plausibility, to devoting a few leisure days to collection of facts, by which the question might be set for rest forever. It was a hasty judgment, as he was later to find, but the aspiring naturalist, Bennett, found himself not idle. When his ship stopped at Erromanga in the New Hebrides, now Vanuatu, to raid sandalwood forests, he plucked a live specimen of the rare pearly nautilus, known previously only by its shell, floating in the water of the bay, and achieved a scientific coup. He bagged a living fossil, the sole living genus of the mollusk subclass Nautilia, which included a fossil of the ammonites, which was of great interest to systematists. While Bennett, back in England in 1831-32, presented his system to the Hunterian Museum and wrote his discovery on the London Medical Gazette, Richard Owen seized the scientific potential of the delicate organism and published a superb description of the memoir of the pearly nautilus. In the following year, modelled on Cuvier's systematic work, it placed the youthful naturalist at the forefront of a comparative anatomist and won him the coveted election to the Royal Society at London. Bennett also had much to gain. He was present at the museum when Owen dissected the specimen of the five female ornithorhynchus. I will learn how to pronounce that. That led his conclusion that the mammary glands and watched his friends inject mercury into the tiny lateral jacks. The platypus mystery was etched in his mind. Oh. Gee, that's keeping on coming up. Mercury in there. In May 1832, Bennett was on the ship brothers bound for Sydney. This time he donned a naturalist suit. Spending only a brief time in the busy Sydney township, he rode out in September across the Great Dividing Range and trained observer to reach to search out and report the elusive platypus, journeying some distance through the green-grey countryside and finding vegetation melancholy. He got his first sight of the animal in the Kurajibi and Marajuji River. On perceiving it, he recorded it. The spectator must remain perfectly stationary. A slight noise or movement would cause the instant disappearance. So acute is the sight of hearing, perhaps both. And it seldom reappears when it's been frightened. By remaining perfectly quiet when the animal is up, the spectator is unable to obtain an excellent view of its movements. It seldom, however, remains longer than 1 or 2 minutes, playing or paddling on the surface, as soon diving again and reappearing for short time above or below. Its mode of swimming is very singular and not always alike. Sometimes it's, the body of the animal, beaver-like, is partly raised above the surface of the water, while others, particularly in the still pools, every part is submerged except for the upper surface of the bill and nostrils, and these being but sufficiently elevated above the water to enable the animal to breathe. It is only by little rings which this operation creates upon the surface that the presence is detected. He was also struck by wonder. When seen in a living state running along the ground, he wrote, the animal conveys to the spectator an idea of something supernatural. Its uncouth form produces terror in the minds of the timid. Even the canine race stare at them with erect ear. The feline race avoids them. At the twilight of the Murrumbidgee, he shot a female, which wounded died that night. Next day, he dug out a live female from its burrow, determined to get this piece of scientific evidence with the best possible condition back to England, or at least where it might be dissected under good conditions. Bennett rode off with a little animal attached to his mount in a box. 100 kilometres on, the travelling platypus escaped. September through October, platypus breeding months in the cooler regions of Australia. Early in November, Bennett was again in the field, retracing his steps across the Razorback Mountains and Gobel Plains, and back through the Murrumbidgee region where his found was made. And there, at Yass, his perseverance paid off. At a secluded spot in the Yass River, he secured a female with what she suspected to be mammary glands, and another place on the ponds, 3 young ones in a burrow. The young died soon after capture. But on his return route to Sydney and Goulburn, Bennett found that a young male and a female had a grown female, and setting up a rough platypus box crowded with catch grass and sordid worms, he started on horseback. The platypus bill had been described as the most remarkable organ of sensory perception found in the animal kingdom. Moist, soft, and slightly flexible, quite unlike a hard bill of a duck. The whole is covered with a dense array of pores leading to a highly specialized, sensitive touch corpuscles which give the animal acute sense, extra sense. For creatures with such delicate apparatus, the horse, jog, trot in a crowded box proved traumatizing when the grown female died. Bennett dissected, preserved her on the spot and carried the 2 young platypuses back to Sydney. At 28, George Bennett now saw himself as a man with a mission, the first European naturalist to capture 4 highly elusive platypuses from the barrows. He planned the impossible, to tame, domesticate the 2 young animals and take them back as scientific prizes to America. From our perspective, in 2000, the difficulties are recognisably monumental, but in 1832, he was a pioneer, intrigued and hopeful. He kept the 2 small creatures in a prepared box as a resident in Sydney for almost 5 days, releasing them for periods to scutter about in his rented rooms. After a 300-kilometre journey on horseback, he reported in a letter to in February 1833. Young animals came much thinner, although they appeared to feed on bread and water and chopped meat, which I gave them. 1 female died a few days since from the effects of the fall, for they had run about my room. the male is living, lively and seems to be gaining flesh. It's most interesting, harmless and normal, but restless and difficult to keep quiet when once awake, but they sleep much during the day and also night, only coming out of their birth a short time to feed and play about the room. The diet of the platypus has subsequently been proven to be a huge daily intake of small crustaceans and river insects. Not surprisingly, the young male did not survive. Bennett preserved the specimens, and sent them to Owen. Items that include uteri, etc., female Orthinhochinus showing an egg in a left uterus, which is laid open. This preparation, Bennett added, was left unopened until I arrived in Sydney, where I laid it open before Mr. McClay. The second bottle contained organs of generation, the female showing eggs in the left uterus, that smaller size than the preceding specimen. The uteri laid open, the eggs taken out, so the uterus detached from the surrounding parts showing eggs, most of the first stage. Still another preparation showed a gland and a duct communicating with a spur on the male platypus. So that's the poisonous platypus. It's got a poisonous gland on it. There's one spur which venom is secreted by mature males. Dispatching this rich haul of fauna to the ship, brothers Bennett tucked in other specimens of interest to fuel his friends Owen's continued interest in the generation of kangaroo. One, a kangaroo uterus showing the fetus with the placenta attached was, Bennett thought, decisive of the animals being brought forth in the usual way, rather than as still wildly suspected as being born in a false womb of the mother's pouch. Bennett was right. On evidence, Owen published a key paper on the generation of the kangaroo in 1834, which announced his discovery that the kangaroo was young and was developed in the uterus and not in the nipple and the pouch, thus stamping his name in the zoological field. So Owen did it. Bennett, with a good score behind him, zigzagging back to London in the same year, was awarded a gold medal by the Royal College of Surgeons for zoological preservations. In 1835, with one more sea voyage behind him, the inveterate traveller put up his shingle as a practising physician in Sydney. Well, see, this is, you put up your shingle. I don't know whether people normally say this. Okay. At the same time, the invitation of Colonial Secretary of New South Wales, Alexander Maclay, a man of science himself, the energetic Bennett took up the secretary of the small, recently founded Colonial Museum of Sydney and set about cataloguing its collection. So he's the start of the Sydney Museum. In 1835, Bennett also published his major descriptive paper, quote, Notes on the Natural History and Habitats of the platypus, I'm not going to pronounce it, Blum, and Transactional Zoological Society of London, which for the first time presented a detailed eyewitness account of the living platypus and its ecology to the scientific community. This is actually a great scene in zoos. I've been told that the platypus is in a creek, but I haven't seen it. Bennett's lucid prose described the appearance of the curious beak and hem, once thought to be a freakish fraud on a live animal. The head is rather flat, he relayed, and from the mouth projects two flat lips or mandibles resembling a beak to a shoveler duck, and the lower of which is shorter and narrower than the upper. And it has internal edges channeled with numerous striae, resembling to some degree those seen on the bill of a duck. The central portion of the mandibles are a bony continuation skull. Anterior and laterally cartilaginous substance, perfectly movable, extends from the bony portion a distance of 5/8 of an inch. The most distinctive and transverse fold or flap of the membrane layer at the base of both the lower and upper mandibles. Home, from his dissections earlier in the century, had considered the platypus' use of these folds to prevent the beak from being pushed beyond part of its soft mud when foraging. But Bennett, studying the animal's actions on the spot, saw the flaps as affording protection of the eyes of the animal buried in the mud. the eyes themselves sat high on the head, were very small and brilliant. Describing the varying state of the ova found in the uterus of a number of female platypuses he had dissected, he found they were uniformly spherical in form, deep yellow in colour, smooth, with an exterior surface of yellow-coloured yolk occupying different parts of the ovum according to its size. Such first-hand data extended the fragmentary pieces of information that had earlier come to hand, but much to his disappointment, Bennett saw no rudiments of an embryo in any specimen. Nonetheless, his information about the mammary glands newly killed specimens was especially timely and confirmed the accuracy of Bowen's interpretive dissections. At first, Bennett recorded, quote, "I was rather surprised to observe scarcely any appearance of it. One female specimen who had just produced her young, the glands were very large, vascular on the surface and the mammary artery crossed them in the most beautiful distinct manner. It was, there was no projecting nipple." Bennett's success in securing platypus specimens, male and female, impregnated and young in the barrows, and the detail of the fresh observations and sections that once marked him invaluable naturalist in the field and secured his election to the Fellow of the Zoological Society of London. But how to catch platypus, both scientific and popular readers were soon to learn. Quote, "The opinion that I had heard advanced from Sydney of being requisite to shoot the water mole dead instantly, otherwise it would sink and not reappear. I did not find it to be correct in practice. If the animal is wounded, it immediately sinks, but soon reappears on the surface of the water some distance beyond the place which it was seen to die. Some require two or three shots before they are killed or so severely wounded as to enable them to be brought out of the water. They frequently evade being captured, even when wounded, by frequently and rapid diving. Sometimes, too, useless a sportsman is vigilant. They come up among the reeds and rushes, which are plentiful in some parts, and no doubt also that some which sink after being wounded escape into their burrows." Central to his early endeavours of locating and securing platypus was the aid provided by Aborigines. The enterprising Bennett readily had some experience of indigenous people when he began his forays in Australia. In New Hebrides and America, he had gallantly rescued a local girl threatened with death by her kinsmen and had taken her back to England. It was an Aborigine at Yass who introduced him to the vital platypus habitat, the burrow, revealing its entrance concealed among the long grass about a foot from the water's edge. The burrows were long and labyrinth. In searching them, Bennett observed that the Aborigines had great skill and economy of action and did not lay the burrow entirely open, but they delved holes at certain distance to introduce a stick just as they a direction previously to gain digging up upon it. This labour-saving method enabled them to explore the whole length of a burrow to its broad overshell nesting chamber at the end without the angst of opening it entirely. The whole of the interior, Bennett noted, was a smooth extending about 20 feet of serpentine direction up to the bank. It had an entrance near the water's edge and another under the water communicating with the interior of the opening of just the upper entrance. The complex burrows, the platypus shield against the threatening world, were the naturalist's greatest obstacle. Dug a foot or more below the earth's surface, they became narrower as they receded from the entrance, which itself was only about the usual size of an animal when uncontracted. The first one he examined extended a distance of 3 meters. This in itself was a skillful excavation of the animal, a mere 23 to 25 centimetres long, but whose powerful muscular feet had claws extracted acted as a counterpoint. Other burrows, Bennett found, had later extended in a serpentine form a distance of 12 metres from the entrance, and one or two more an astonishing 16 metres. Finding local Aboriginals living among the banks of the Murrumbidgee and later Yass, Bennett concluded that they could shed light on the habitats of the animal, and especially its manner of giving birth and carrying young. He recorded their names for the platypus, Malong and Tambeat, from the tribes of the Murrumbidgee areas, names that he carefully added to a varying scientific nomenclature of the platypus, in which he catalogued the collection for the Australian Museum. There you go. But on the subject of Tambeat's birth process, he drew confusing stories. Yes, Aboriginals, he recorded, at first asserted the animals lay eggs, but very shortly afterwards contradicted themselves. Testing the reliability of the evidence, Bennett drew an overlay which they agreed looked like that of the Malong, and then a round egg which they declared to be that of Malong. The Aboriginals said, all women have eggs, there are so many days, the number which they did not know, the young ones tumble down on the two eggs, and that two eggs are laid in one day. It was difficult going. Torn between the evidence and that the Aborigines from different tribes in the Tumut country, he said that Tambi, no make eggs, tumble down, Pickaninny, make tumble down. He was none the wiser as to whether the young were born alive, hatched from an egg within the platypus oviparous, or if the egg was laid for hatching. The broad testimony of the Aborigines was that the young were found in the burrow as just brought forth, but Bennett added the difficulty from they find in expressing themselves in one language, we often misunderstand them. Bennett's dilemma of understanding Aboriginal testimony mirrored that of early inquirers such as Robert Brown. Brown, responding to Banks' hard pressure for information, had also questioned Aboriginal people about the platypus' birth process, and informed Banks that from his questioning he had nothing to add. In fact, he had. A surviving draft of Brown's letter to Banks in 1803 revealed that he omitted a telling paragraph from his final letter, which read, quote, from a vague reports collected from the natives, it might be supposed that the egg is hatched outside the body. But Brown admitted, I have already learned to be very careful depending on what they assert in such cases. Patronising British attitudes to the Australian Aborigines went deep. On first contact, Cook commented the Aborigines' simplicity and happiness, although he noted Botany Bay, they appeared to want nothing more than for us to be gone. But as a naturalist, young Banks, following his idyllic Tahitian days, just the first average Australians only one degree removed from brutes. Graphic depictions of indigenous habitants, idealised by engravers' arts, intimately conveyed a sense of noble savage and its primitive debasement. But one thing was sure. Both settlers and visitors came together on the point. Australia's first inhabitants were unreliable. Bennett concurred, although his interest in Aboriginal health and customs was strong and his respect for the people and adoption of their words for animals and places was more serious than most of his contemporaries. Yet, caught between conflicting evidence, he was careful when seeking information about the platypus' birth, not to ask any person who had been repeatedly questioned before on the same subject. He noticed there were a marked tendency among Aboriginals to please their interlocutors. It depended on how and when their questions were asked. Yet, for men, the exact valuable data. So this is like there's a different understanding of information, a different relationship. Like everything is, like the information and knowledge is actually social knowledge. We think of our knowledge as inside our head. The knowledge is more communal knowledge. So I understand. Yet for Bennett, the exact valuable data came from his way, unsolicited, wrapped in pigeon speak. One such occasion, he was dissecting a female platypus for the elusive mammary gland. He recalled in his letter writing that a native was overlooking me, perfectly aware, although I had not informed him, for what I saw. He pointed out its situation, saying at the same time, "Milken, come all the same as from a cow." When I told him that I could hardly see it, he replied, "When Piccaninny come and Cabodon large Milken come," so the Piccaninnies, when the baby comes, milk comes. On the question of the platypus generation, however, Bennett's mind was pretty well made up from his dissections of the captured platypus and sent to Owen in 32, which he found a loose ova in the uterus. Owen figured and described the specimen in the paper of the Royal Society in 1834, and a conclusion took shape in both men's minds that the platypus did not produce its young like other mammals, viviparous by live birth, but it either laid an egg or was oviparous, producing a young from eggs hatched within the body. The preference for the oviparous mode, consolidated over a great span of years, had marked consequences for the biological science. Of course, I think they lay the egg and then the egg hatches. Okay, that's the end of chapter 5 and 6. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.